Committee on Agricultural and Natural Resources. It's Wednesday, April the 28th, 1999. And at this time, I'm going to go a little bit off schedule. We have Representative Thompson here, and we're going to talk about a bill that has both of our names on it, and it is Senate Bill 1316. And with that, I'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 1316. Representative Thompson.
Thank you. Representative Terry Thompson, House District 4 in the Central Oregon Coast. Senate Bill 1316 is an issue that I've pondered on for years, ever since we put the first parking fees on state parks that are adjacent to the ocean. Originally, I worked with Tom McCall when we made our open beach access bills in this state. And the idea behind it at that time was that the beaches should be open to everyone. At that time, it was under the Department of Transportation. And what has happened is the state parks have created a fee on a few parks up and down along the Oregon coast. And it's a parking fee, they say. But what it does is it limits anyone who doesn't live right next to the beach from using those, because most people have to drive to and find a place to park and consequently have to put in the $3 charge. That can have all kinds of effects on the local community and the people there. I know that I'll first relate a story that when I was in California in the middle of the winter in Northern California, I stopped and wanted to go to a beach. At the time, I just parked next to the road and walked down to the beach with my wife and son and thought, nice day. And when I came back, there was a state policeman writing me a ticket for $25 because I didn't pay that $5 parking fee. I immediately got in the car and drove out of the state. Got back to Oregon, where we had free and open beaches, except for this parking fee on some of those local parks along the coast. I believe that we're probably in violation of the law, because the intention between the beach bill, there's some wording in there that says there'll be no fees, charges, or tariffs assessed to people in the state of Oregon. But what we've done is it's like we build a toll bridge. Yes, you have the option to go on it or not. But what we've done is created a situation where, I'll describe the toll bridge. We say, okay, a toll bridge is free, but then we put a gate on each end of the bridge and charge you for it. And that's what we've done with these parks on the coast. We said, okay, we got a free beach, but now we're going to charge you for the park. I don't believe that was the intention of Governor McCall, and I don't believe that was the intention of the people of the state of Oregon. It's a particularly tough situation for local people if they want to use the beach all the time, because they get charged $3 every time they go there. For a person who comes from the Willamette Valley, he may only go once a year. So it's not that unreasonable of a fee. But so if somebody uses the beach a lot, it can get pretty expensive. The other thing that bothers me is if you have a beach park like this and you start charging $3, well, some people don't want to pay $3, so they go park on all the adjacent landowners' property. So there's a bunch of reasons why this $3 fee is a deterrent for what I believe is the attention of the people of the state of Oregon when we pass the open beach law. And that's the basic reason I wanted this bill to come forward. I very much appreciate the chairman of this committee also signing on. I believe it's good for the people of the state of Oregon. One thing in the bill, though, I want to note is that in the case of a highly developed park, which is down on the south coast in the Coos Bay area, where they have the big gardens and a lot of maintenance, that's quite a bit different situation from what most of these little day-use parks are along the coast. There's a side benefit to it. I think if we remove our parking fees, I would like to see the federal government remove their parking fees to a beach that we own in Quinnahead. I happen to live adjacent to that. I had a lot of problems with the way that's been managed. I've been working with BLM, and I think if we don't step up and take care of our own situation in our own state, then we shouldn't be asking for the federal government to do it. There was a lot of things that went on there. We were charging kids from the state of Oregon $3 to go in on a bus. It's a long problem, but if we pass this bill, I think it's going to be one more notch in the quiver to open up every beach for every citizen of the state of Oregon to use our beaches.
Sure, I think you're absolutely representative. I think you're right in the sense that, you know, you and I have talked about what the requirements under the federal law would indicate that they cannot be. And here we go, we're doing it. And I think you're absolutely right. I think this bill sends a message that, by golly, we're not going to do it. We're going to expect you to step up and honor agreements that you have relative to access to the beach.
One thing I would like to state is that also, I really don't like to take money away from the parks budget, but I believe that a lot of times these costs are almost equivalent to what the money they return. I'll let them state that. But also, we have 66 money that's supposed to get to them, and that's one area, so they should be able to adjust at this time. And I'll let them address that.
That's my desire, and I think we talked just before we began here. Parks guy signed up, right? Jim has signed up. Jim, where's Jim? Oh, there you are. I'm sorry. Jim, are you on stage for a little bit?
Yes, sure.
Jim, why don't you come on up and fill in the committee on what you and I were talking about, how we may be able to address some of the areas that Representative Thompson was talking about that may be highly improved and that probably do deserve to have some key relative to the to its our use.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Jim Lockwood, Government Relations Manager for the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. A couple of comments, if I may, in response. I don't have any formal testimony on this. There's two basic issues that I would like to address. One is kind of the simple broad overview is that we would prefer the commission be left with the decision-making authority in this case, but just that they're close to the issue and receive lots of testimony on this. So that's the first point, leave it with the commission where it's been. The second is the fiscal impact is, of course, a concern to us, no surprise. The way we figured out the net fiscal impact on this particular bill of rights written has a little bit of interpretation here. So if I could explain for a moment. The net is that it comes out, from our interpretation, $106,000. And when I say net, Representative Thompson's correct. There is a variety of things involved in collecting the fees, the machines, and the staff time, and so on. The other piece is that the bill explicitly accepts Shore Acres State Park. In our mind, there are a couple of others on the coast that also are major investments that may have beach access incidental, but really where it's like Ecola State Park has beach access, but really the parking is to serve the more heavily invested part of the park in terms of the infrastructure and upland areas that are used.
On that one, how far is it to the next free parking access location?
I have to admit that I'm not familiar. I'm too new still. I don't know.
Okay.
I'd love to be able to answer. I just can't tell you right now. Another example is Fort Stevens. Fort Stevens, we have parking for free where somebody can drive to it to the beach access. Elsewhere at the park there, we have a couple of different day use areas that are for areas that are not beach access, a whole separate area of the park. And so that's our interpretation. To us, it doesn't need to be legislated that those, because beach access there is free. It's just separate where we have the day use fee. So the way we take it is the intent is that where it is for the purpose of beach access, we would not be able to have a fee. And so our bottom line was that by the time you take out the cost of collecting the fee, the net is $106,000 short. And that's just something we would need to absorb one way or another in lots of ways and means found that they decided there's $106,000 somewhere else to put in. So that's really my only comment.
Thank you. You are aware that Measure 66 did pass. sizable amounts of funds are headed your way.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilde, yes, I have heard lots of talk about that around here. And, it's a lot of our fees go to our staffing, frankly, and And a lot of measures, these are not so mutually exclusive that you can draw a clear line, but a lot of measures, 66 money is going into repair, renovation, and other specific targeted things. And so we get nervous when a lot of things are targeted and something else isn't, and the fees don't come in. We can end up short in one area when we are fully funded in another. It's just a matter of the balance.
Follow up. Thank you. Additionally, does it not bother you in some way that if the original intent, which I believe to be correct, was that these be free and available for the people to access the beach, that charging a fee is somewhat not consistent with the original intent?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wilde, I think there are a variety of things about our fees on the coast or elsewhere that bother us. Probably some of those concerns we had, we were forced to overcome when we were short and got in kind of the mindset, maybe, of charging and paying our own way. And that has some advantages. You know, it does make you look at your costs and try to pare them down so you don't have to charge outrageous amounts to cover. So it has some benefits. But, yeah, we do have mixed feelings about the charges. So I don't in any way want to imply that we think this is not appropriate to consider, or you're within the bounds of what our own concerns are.
Jeremy, if this should pass, I'm going to refer back to something that Representative Thompson said, and that was, yeah, we may say the access to the beach is free, but we're going to charge you for the parking. Is it our understanding from you that the intent of this bill is clear, that when in fact these are not highly improved facilities that obviously would be deserving of some sort of fee because they're very expensive to maintain under those circumstances, that this would mean also a reasonable parking and access?
Absolutely, okay. Without a doubt.
And relative to the issue, for the record, we had a raising of the right hand.
That's correct. That's correct.
One of the issues that we were a little bit concerned about as we looked at this bill was the idea that we have a bill that's requiring you, or not requiring you, but encouraging you to run out, to go out and solicit additional access to the beach, and to actually maybe assume some responsibility for new beach access. The issue is we are very concerned about the revenue flow, because I think the reason that you just stated that the fees came on board was the fact that we did have the idea that parks were going to be closed and access was going to be closed. And, you know, and the legislature stepped up last session and said $25 million more, don't do that. And so with Measure 66 dollars, I know all of us here have been, you know, fighting to make sure those dollars stay here and that we can get back to where we should be, as Representative Thompson said, and that is, and Senator Wilde, a free access to that shoreline.
One of the things that, you know, this area, and I'm not going to quit on this issue, even if I'm not a legislator in the future, is that this BLM property, if I was to go over and say, look, the state of Oregon has said there'll be no fees charged, that means for you too. And with the other information I have on the Quiet Title Act and several other things, I want them to pull that off of that park. I do not want the federal government stopping any Oregon citizen going from any beach, and I want that loud and clear to this Parks Department and to the federal government that these are open for the citizens of the United States. It is truly one of the great wonders of the world, and as close to the ocean as most people ever get is to walk on one of these beaches in our state.
Okay, no further questions. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing part of this, but we may bring this back if we ever get a quorum. So, Representative, would you want us to contact you as we get closer, if we go to work session? Or
sure.
I think everybody here is agreeable, but
well,
it's up to you.
I'd like, you know, I want to...
Okay.
If I ever speak on one of the representatives from the East, I will.
That's what we're counting on. Okay, I'm going to... Oh, okay. All right. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1316, and I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1267. Brad, tell us about the bill and where we are. We didn't ask that to happen last time, but I think there was a clear explanation for 1316 what the purpose of the bill was. So,
we're having the two sponsors here. Yeah. You're in good shape.
I think there's no problem. Perfect.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1267 removes requirement that farm labor contractor give written statement and execute written agreements to the farm workers regarding terms and conditions of employment under certain circumstances. I have been informed by the parties to this bill, and you have in front of you correspondence from those folks.
You're talking about Commissioner Roberts and...
Correct. Commissioner Roberts sent a letter saying that they were going to make the changes that were necessary administratively, and that the bill was no longer necessary. And Martin Desmond from the Northwest Forestry Contractors Association was part of those discussions, and perhaps he could come forward and just briefly explain where we are there. And then it's my understanding that we have some other parties that would like to present -1 amendments that will replace the original bill.
Chairman George, other members of the committee, I want to thank you very much for holding a hearing on this bill last week, Senator, and clearly, as you directed, Commissioner Roberts and our association and other associations did meet last Monday, and we've reached an acceptable compromise where this issue will be dealt with administratively, and we have that outlined in that letter before you. So at this point in time, with what BOLI has outlined that they're going to do, we find that acceptable, and so we don't see a need to pursue this bill. And that includes not just our association, but the National Wildfire Suppression Association, the National Environmental Fuels Association, and I think also the Associated Oregon Loggers and also the Associated Oregon Loggers.
Could you explain to us exactly what the solution was?
Well, what I just sort of outlined what I have in my letter is what the Bureau of Labor did. Do you have a copy of that letter? I have.
The original one for that.
Okay, Chairman, there's sort of about 5 or 6 key points we made. One is that the Bureau of Labor and Industries will accept contractors doing what we refer to as a matrix approach, where the contractors will be able to display up front all the contracts and the pay rates that they expect to do. As you recall, I mean, one of our big concerns was the contractors would potentially have to do a new amended disclosure every time. You know, they get to have 5,000 amended disclosures each year. Then the second key point that the Bureau of Labor and Industries is going to do is they're going to be looking at good faith effort by contractors. As you know, we cited a couple of examples where we thought that they're sort of concerned about the crossing of the T's and the dotting of the I's, and we feel that with their statement of good faith effort that they're not going to be chasing after contractors for not properly doing grammar. And then we also talked about pay increases and how they're going to be a little bit more flexible in how to document that. A number of these things I have to admit is we sort of set up a framework for a discussion, and a lot of this is sort of going to be sort of finalized more in an administrative rule process. And Commissioner Roberts also said that he would do some stuff administratively immediately.
Okay, if you would keep this committee informed in the interim, because it was fairly alarming what we heard the other day as to what was being expected of you. It seemed like there could have been a way to work it out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad you've come to this compromise, but do keep us informed. A formal request that you do that,
mm-hmm.
And we'll see. We'll watch the progress of that change.
Okay. Well, let's see. I want to thank you, Chairman, and I also want to thank Senator Ferriola for your work.
Thank you. Now, Brad, tell us what the amendments would do to the bill. I mean, at this point, I have...
Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, with your indulgence, I would ask John McCulley to come forward and speak to the amendments, since he is the drafter of this.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, Senator Wild. John McCulley, I'm representing the tree fruit growers, and with me is Tom Nelson from the Hood River Grower Shippers Association, and we're here to speak to the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 1267 that you have. I'm going to let Mr. Nelson explain the amendments and what they do. I just want to briefly tell the committee why we are here. These amendments relate to the federal H-2A program related to bringing in foreign workers to the United States. We have been exploring, taking a step back, the tree fruit industry had never really used farm labor contractors in the past, and in Oregon and not looked at the H-2A program, but as concerns have been growing over the availability of a legal workforce to work in the industry, certainly other alternatives have been explored. We originally looked at Senate Bill 980 to bring this amendment to you, and agreed that probably wasn't the right vehicle to do that because, as you might imagine, these amendments will have some controversy to them. And Senate Bill 980, Senator Castillo's bill, probably should not be the vehicle, and so we did not pursue amendments to that after we discovered that it would be in our best interest not to do that. So we're bringing them in a separate bill, are a separate amendment to Senate Bill 1267. As drafted, they merely amend Senate Bill 1267, but you just heard the testimony that the original language in Senate Bill 1267 is not needed, so we would be asking the committee to replace the language in 1267 with amendments as we have outlined. I will let Mr. Nelson explain what the amendments do. I think you have some information from him, and then I'm sure you will hear from other folks about that.
Yes, thank you. My name is Tom Nelson. I'm the executive director of the Hood River Grower Shipper Association. Our members are very concerned about a legal workforce. We're looking at alternatives and opportunities that we've never looked at before, which include farm labor contractors, such as the agreement we came to in Senate Bill 980. Another one is H-2A. There is an organization that is in the process of being formed out of Yakima that would work in the states of Idaho, Washington, and Oregon on for people, for growers who need labor under the H-2A program. The H-2A program has been around for years, and it is used on the East Coast. People that use it have made a lot of comments about how once you get into the program, it's a very technical program, but it's doable, but of course it's pretty rough to get started. And on the West Coast, we've just never really had to use it. I believe last year around 25,000 agricultural workers came in under the H-2A program, again, primarily used on the East Coast. What I have before you is just a little comparison between farm labor contractor rules and regulations, Oregon farm labor contractor, and H-2A. As I understand it, the issue would be, are there protections? As Senator Castillo continually says, she wants more protection, and she wants protection for farm workers who does not want to go backwards. And we believe that the H-2A program has even more protections than farm labor contractor. The H-2A program is a federal program. It's not a state program. And by layering the farm labor Oregon's farm labor contractor rules on it, you're actually adding another layer of regulation that we don't believe is necessary. We don't believe it's necessary at all. And the reason why I did this little simple graph here was just to show that there are even greater protections for H-2A than farm labor contractor. And I don't want to bore you, but the H-2A program is very technical. And the only way you can do it successfully is to have a lot of money or to get a large organization together so you have a lot of people contributing small amounts to one place. Schmidt Nursery put an H-2A application in last year and has spent a lot of money, 2 years ago I put one in, has spent a lot of money for that, have another application in this year, and the finances are continuing. So it is not something for the small grower. I represent an industry that has a lot of small growers, so we need to form into an association in order to do it successfully. I could go through some of the highlights of this. For example, when you get into an H-2A program, you have to be certified well in advance by the Department of Labor. And for us, it would be Region 10 out of Seattle. And you have to establish what the prevailing practices are in the area. When you bring the H-2A workers in, you can't vary from the prevailing practices.
They HTA workers are under a adverse effective wage rate or the prevailing rate, whichever is highest. An hourly rate, the minimum under the AWER is $7.32 an hour. That's over our minimum rate. The prevailing rate has to be the same. Whatever the prevailing rate for the workers on in other work practices cannot change for HTA workers. And I might add that domestic workers have to get paid the higher rate if you've got H2A on the place. So there's also a bump to the, for the other workers. Housing for H2A is required. It's not for farm labor contractor. Job descriptions are required. The terms and conditions of employment and housing have to be approved by the Department of Labor. Here, terms and conditions of employment and housing are just between the worker and the employer, as far as the farm labor contractor side goes. One big difference is with the H2A program, the employer actually pays the worker. This is not a middle person. You're not paying a farm labor contractor as some who then pays it. You are directly paying the employer, which moves it a little bit different from being a farm labor contractor. Inbound transportation has to be paid. It can be reimbursed later if that's a prevailing practice. You don't pay it, but you do have to pay the inbound to come in under farm labor contractor. That's not required. Legal services and Oregon Law Center have the same access to these workers, have the same ability to find out where they're housed, and in other states, they are active in looking for transgressions under the H2A program as well as they are under current Oregon farm worker situation. One thing about it, though, is the H2A worker can't work for anyone. They can only work for a certified employer. All they can do, and the workers are guaranteed. The employer under the H2A is guaranteed a legal workforce because these workers come in, you know, totally legal. Whereas under the farm labor contractor, the contractor just does the I-9 process. So we believe that there's a lot of protections for the worker, much more than farm labor contractor, and we do not need to have a duplicate effort of both of an H2A organization having to meet these very strict federal standards and Oregon farm labor contractor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, I noticed that the H2A does not have a check by unemployment insurance and Social Security.
Correct.
Could you make a statement about that change?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, because these are non-immigrant aliens, I believe is the word, coming into the country, they are not eligible for Social Security or unemployment. However, if an employer, this is a very technical law, and I believe in some cases the employer has to pay part of it, because in agriculture, some employers, if they're under 20,000, don't pay unemployment anyway. But if they do pay unemployment, I believe they have to pay at least the employer portion, but not the employee portion. But remember that there is a cost to bring the workers in, and you have to pay the higher, the AWER or the prevailing rate. And so for an agricultural employer, you don't use this program to save money. You use this program to have a workforce.
Reminds me a little bit of the, and I don't remember the details because I was relatively young back in the early 50s, the Bracero program, very strict rules that had to be abided by. You had to provide housing, guarantee in and out. But one question I have is a worker can, workers can work for anyone. The answer was no under that provision. What happens if the relationship between the employer and the employee is not working out? Do we then have a responsibility then to deliver that person back to their home? Is that what happens in that
situation? If there's a dispute, if there's a workplace dispute, it initially would probably go through the employment office. The actual technical groups that operate it are the Employment Standards Administration and the Employment and Training Administration. Both are Region 10. And I don't know if in Portland they actually have a division office, a wage and hours office that works on that. But they would be the one who becomes involved. And if a worker has a dispute, then there's a whole process, and there's back wages, it's the full gamut that we're under right now. There's no shortcuts to it, plus civil action even, if they chose to. But if the worker just isn't working out and wants to go home, the employer pays the employer pays to have the worker come halfway through the work contract. The
the worker pays to come up, then halfway through the work contract, the employer has to then pay the worker that half to come up. And if the worker is then responsible for getting themselves back.
We're just discussing exactly what to do with the timetable. I want the committee to be able to look at this a little bit of time, but the time is short. So, were you two finished? I'll see if anybody signed up. Thank you.
Thank you, Major.
Thank you. We do have some person else.
One more. Michael Dale, please.
How are you?
How are you this morning? Fine. This afternoon, this evening. Michael Dale from Oregon Law Center for the record. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm signed up in opposition to 1267. Actually, we participated in the discussions with the reforestation contractors and concur in the dispositions that were made there and don't see any legal obstacles to that at all. And to the extent that I noticed that in the letter from the reforestation contractor that says that we hadn't said whether we agreed or we disagreed, we agree. So we don't have any problems with that aspect. We're fine with the dispositions that have been proposed there. I rise to speak against the bill because of the dash one amendment, and we're completely opposed to those amendments for several reasons. First of all, with respect to the comparison of protections, the year before, major proposals to completely rewrite the federal H-2A program. And so to the extent that the committee was going to rely upon federal protections for Oregon workers, they may be non-existent next year. A bill passed the Senate last year that would have deleted most of these protections that are listed here. Secondly, we oppose it because our experience around the country where people do use H-2A workers is that H-2A associations frequently use farm labor contractors to recruit workers both from abroad, usually in Mexico these days, sometimes in the West Indies, and there's a requirement to recruit U.S. workers because U.S. workers have preference for those jobs, and they use contractors to recruit U.S. workers. We think it's inappropriate to say that the U.S. workers that are recruited to these jobs ought not to have the same protection any other U.S. workers should have. And as to not protecting the foreign workers, that probably violates the NAFTA side agreement, because it would be a preferential treatment of U.S. workers over foreign workers, and that's banned by the NAFTA side agreement on labor.
H-2A, that probably has been able to deal with that issue, hasn't it? So your concern would be as if, in fact, the whole issue of the federal government's H-2A program went away? Is that the...
Well, that's one of the concerns. The second concern is if Oregon chose to provide greater protections to its own domestic workers than it did to migratory workers coming from Mexico, because it exempted them from coverage under our Farm Labor Contractor Act, that would probably violate the federal treaty with the Republic of Mexico. There was a side agreement to the NAFTA agreement on labor, which prohibits discriminatory treatment of migratory workers from another country. Beyond that, it's bad policy. It should be a level playing field, whether you get H-2A workers or you get U.S. workers. There ought not to be an advantage in bringing in foreign workers. You should have the same requirements and the same policies that everybody else in the country has followed since 1953 when this act was first adopted. And so we would propose those amendments. I might add that I didn't learn about these amendments until about 30 minutes ago. I can assure the committee this will be extremely controversial, that there will be other people who will want to hear about this, and I would urge the committee not to move this out without giving at least some opportunity for the public to be heard on this matter.
Did you hear the comment before you came up that if my concern was that we made sure the committee had a chance to look at this?
I did hear that, Mr. Chair.
Eliminates one bill and establishes a brand new one with major implications. Okay, so we will honor that commitment. We have a short time to do that, so you folks be happy if we get the information that you want to have on this.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm going to go ahead and, was anybody else trying to? Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1267. And where do you think we should go right now? Okay, let's do it. I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 940. Brad, tell us about that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 940 exempts glass container manufacturers from recycled glass requirement under specified circumstances, eliminates the increase in minimum recycled glass requirement, requires glass containers manufactured outside Oregon to meet minimum recycled glass requirements of the state where the containers are manufactured, but not the Oregon minimum requirement. Mr. Chair, we have brought this bill back. We heard it originally on the 15th, and there were -1 amendments drafted up at the request of the committee that would require any city with a population larger than 250,000 to sort glass containers by color, and the intent of that was to increase the usable glass color supply, which is apparently limited for certain types of colors.
And who was signed up to testify?
First up to testify, we have Mark Nelson representing the Glass Packaging Institute.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Glass Packaging Institute. As I indicated to you at the last hearing, we were we excused ourselves into some meetings with a variety of parties regarding this issue. We have reached agreement on a draft among some of the parties, and DEQ is still reviewing the particular amendments and will be coming back to us probably tomorrow or on Monday as to where they're going to be in terms of the agreement. I do anticipate that we'll be able to reach agreement among the major parties. There have been some individuals who have participated in previous discussions but did not participate in today's final discussion and version, and they still have to review it as well. But why don't I walk you through we have provided for you. We did have amendments drafted by Legislative Council prior to our last meeting today where we reached other agreements. So what I've done for you is provide some proposed amendments which reflect that agreement, and I believe in the proper form that would need to be taken to Council. And then I've provided a hand and broke copy which I will refer to. What we've done is we've retained the 50% requirement. And in our original bill, we had moved that back to 35% to reflect what is the recycled content in California, their language. But we reached an agreement today to keep the 50%, but to extend the timeline on the 50% until 2004. We had considerable discussion about what is happening in California, whether they may be able to climb back up to 50%. We don't believe they can do that now. But there are things occurring in the marketplace that may in the future allow, and I think there were concerns that we not close the door on 50% at this point, but to push it back out. So you'll see that in under sub 2B. We also, the main concern was how this was on the glass manufacturers on the West Coast. There are glass manufacturers principally in Oklahoma who shipped in some small amount of containers into the state, but our concern was principally what happens in terms of recycled content on the West Coast. So that is why you see language that says for glass containers manufactured in Oregon or within 750 miles of the borders of the state, which will basically handle all of the glass manufacturers on the Pacific coast. Moving then to page two, we have described to you some particular technological problems that are related to what's called dead leaf green, which produces basically as a Chardonnay bottle, and a particular manufacturer in Seattle that produces those Chardonnay bottles for Oregon wine growers and wineries. So what you see at the top of the second page is an amendment that deals with the granting of or the ability for a manufacturer to come to the Department of Environmental Quality and to ask what we call a technological exemption. They have to provide the data, and then the department has to make a determination as to whether they meet the standards of that exemption. And there is agreement on this particular element. Again, with DEQ still reviewing where they're going to be, but I believe they're going to be supported. Another amendment that we made to further modify this is in C, where we say a manufacturer requesting exemption from the recycled glass content requirements under the section shall inform the department on the steps it plans to take in order to come into compliance with the recycled content requirement. The department shall grant exemptions for a period of no more than 3 years in any one application. Such exemptions are renewable upon a reasonable showing by the applicant. The department may recover all costs, including cost of rulemaking, if necessary, involved in considering and acting upon exemption requests. So we have now language that addresses the technological exemption, which I should let you know that this is the technological exemption is one that has been in California under their recycled content statutes for many years. So we believe it's something that is in line with what's happening in that state, and we provide, I think, a method by which the department can move forward on that review. Those are the main parts of the bill, and it's something that the Glass Packaging Institute has agreed to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Doug Myers, representing the Association of Oregon Recyclers. Recyclers of all sizes and shapes and organizations and big corporations and medium-sized individuals and so forth. We have been meeting with Mr. Nelson and people that he represents, and we have indeed come to support these. We just reached agreement this morning. I've seen them about an hour ago, and we do support these amendments in the form they are now. I just want to reserve upon my legislative chair who was in a meeting this morning with us and to make sure that the language that is in these amendments is what we agreed to. And if not, I have Mr. Nelson's word that we will work it out on the House side. But we do support these amendments, and we're okay on passing the bill on.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I'd like to direct this to Mr. Nelson. Now, in the amendments, you have 35% on or after January 1st, 1995, and 50% on or after January 1st, 2004. What do you foresee coming along to provide you with the ability to meet the 50% requirement?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wild, our concern on the 50% is, one, we want it to be, we have eight manufacturers in California shipping in empty containers into Oregon. We'd like to have the standard be the same. As you know, at this point in time, Oregon's single manufacturer, Owens Parkway, is over 50%. There is one, my understanding, one manufacturer that's over 50% in California, and then the range, I think, is between 35 and 45%. There are those who feel that that the whole industry is changing and that There may be some other technological advances that are going to enhance the retention of cullet, enhance the use of more cullet. Right now, cullet is very difficult to come by in California. We have in here an exemption for available if cullet is not available, but we would like to have the same standard. So I guess we were swayed today. We'd like to get this thing over with and get it for 35%. But we were swayed today that there may be some changes in the future that may allow manufacturers to get to the 50%, and therefore leave the door open to see if those changes do occur, and if not, we'll be back here in 2003 asking you to approve a 35% limit.
I'd like to follow up. Okay, so currently Orange Brockway is in excess of 50%. However, as we know, one of their prime sources is going to be changing, possibly, their collection methods. How do you foresee that changing the recycled content in that plant, or at least the amount of cullet available to that plant?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Wild, as we indicated at the last hearing, we believe that if those changes that are being discussed with the City of Portland, we believe that will reduce the available cullet to Owens Brockway. Now, the fact that we're moving it to 2004, if that should happen, you know, they have some protection with time. But I can guarantee you, as I indicated in my last statement, if in fact they drop below 50%, Owens Brockway will be sitting here with me in 2001 or 2003 and asking that 35% be the lid.
Just wanted to get that on the list.
One of the issues we attempted to address after initially hearing this was the idea of possibly requiring certain folks to continue to sort so we could have the cullet available to recycling the glass. Now, it's my understanding that with the changes here, you folks don't think that would be necessary to maintain a supply, that you think there's a big enough loophole or a mechanism to get relief if, in fact, there isn't a supply?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we still have that concern, and I want to make that very clear, and I've expressed that to the City of Portland and to other individuals in this discussion. We believe this bill, we would prefer that it's not addressed in this bill, primarily because we've tried to bring all the parties together who have very differing opinions on that particular issue. They've come together. They've I think, been very reasonable in negotiating this package and what we have here. And in respect to that process and that negotiation, we prefer that that wasn't part of this particular bill.
What is right now the response of DEQ?
DEQ wants to go back and discuss with Bob Danko, wants to discuss with his director the issues involving the granting of the exemption and what they see their costs are going to be, even though we've agreed they're going to be recovered by us, and whether or not that process is too onerous. I believe when those discussions are done that we will have their agreement. But that little discussion still has to take place. But we understand you're under a timeline. I've made a commitment to all the parties that if, in fact, there are some issues that are not resolved after we move this, if we move this bill out, that I'm willing to take those up in the House.
Fisher.
Petrol with some of it are solid waste.
Chairman, Senator Fisher, I'm not sure Metro was part of the co-mingling discussion within the City of Portland. A building that my office handled most of those discussions. I don't think they were, but.
Mr. Chair, I don't know either, but you may have some testifiers up here shortly who can answer that question.
If not wanted in another committee, play with Metro. And
not very serious.
Well, there could be suggestions made from other angles to work on this and cooperate in a problem. that might help as to do something to build.
Mr. Chair, if I may address the Dash 1 amendments, AOR, my recyclers don't have a position, at least yet, on them, but as part of the consensus group, we feel that these Dash 1s, again, as an excess, do not belong in 940. Thank you.
Well, I wouldn't say, since that's our decision, that you would be the one deciding whether they belong in there, but do you agree with the concept? I don't agree with the concept.
Our legislative committee is meeting right now. They could be discussing this, and it's their decision. And I realize it's your decision also, Senator.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brad, who's next?
Kristen Mitchell, John Heyer, and Brian Engelson.
Good evening. I'll let you three decide who's going to be first. For the record, give us your name and then proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, if I may just briefly, Kristen Mitchell for Oregon Refuse and Recycling. Are we discussing the Dash 1s at this point? Because if we are not, then you don't need our testimony. And I'd like to save you some time. So.
Well, have you, what are we referring to this as Dash 2?
Yes, yeah, we'll just...
Okay, conception
and no, actually, pardon me. I was referring to the to.
Yes, I understood that, but I mean, I was just asking. Have you had a look at the conceptual amendment?
Yes.
Okay. Why don't you give us your opinion on that first,
okay.
And we'll let all three of you, and then we'll come back and we'll address Dash 1.
Okay, Mr. Chair, for the record, I'm Kristen Mitchell with the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association, and I have with me Brian Engelson. He's the general manager of Eastside Recycling and Oregon Recycling Systems in Portland, and John Heyer, who is the chair of Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association's Governmental Affairs Committee. He also is the general manager of Santa Pack and EcoSort, which are both located in Eugene. And both of these men represent companies that do collection and solid waste processing or recycling processing. As for the conceptual amendments, we did get a chance to review those right before the committee began. And we're fine with whatever the work group decides to do. Frankly, we don't really have a horse in that race. In our opinion, if the glass industry feels that it needs some relief and this committee agrees with that position, then we feel that that's perfectly appropriate. So whatever this group decides to do is fine with us on that issue. Our concern has been and would be the amendments that are related to the prohibition against commingled recycling.
I'm going to ask each of you to keep it relatively short. We have a long schedule, so if you can keep it brief to the point, I love it, I hate it, would be good.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Are you asking if on?
Yeah, no, go ahead, the next person, go ahead and speak to it.
My name is Brian Engelson, and I'm the general manager of Eastside Recycling. A cooperative collection in Portland of right now 28 small independent businessmen. And also, I am the general manager of Oregon Recycling Systems, which is a processing facility where we take materials collected both residentially and commercially and process those. I'm addressing the Dash 1 amendment that would require the Portland, anybody with a 250,000 or more residents to color sort glass. I'm opposed to that amendment for a number of reasons, and I think there's going to be some other testimony on it. And I want to add just a couple of other things besides the economics and what is going on. But right now at Eastside Collection, we have been Eastside Recycling. We've been collecting commingled recycling since 1992. When we put our first trucks on the street, we didn't have enough bins to collect everything and to sort separate it. In the beginning in 1997, we went to a two-stream sort where all fiber was collected separately and then all containers separately. And we found a number of things that we could do it more effectively at a lower cost and hopefully to increase participation in the community. Switching hands now to the processing portion, we started processing commingled collected containers in November of 1997 also. Up to that time, all of our materials had been source separated. When we compare from 1997, December, and then all of 1998, all of the containers that were brought into our facility, which represent approximately 130,000 households, was commingled with tin, aluminum, glass, and plastic all mixed together. When we compare our baseline in 1997, the residuals that we had out of the facility, we have found that we had approximately 0.4% residual, and in 1998, we had 0.5% residual, so virtually no change. All of our materials, we make sure we have the obligation to make sure they are recycled. One other point I want to emphasize is, and I think last time I was here, Senator Wild and Senator Fisher, we were talking about the commercial collection, and we're right on the verge in Portland now. Our target, we've done such a good job in that residential, we're really targeting the commercial, and we built this infrastructure basically off the residential stream. And it is really important to go to a restaurant or a lot of our apartments and stuff and to collect that stuff commingled, because it's real difficult for the to keep that stuff all separated out and in those type of situations. And we're going to be emphasizing in the future that commercial. So we find that if we go back to source separating as we did prior, that it's probably going to negatively affect our commercial collection. And we'll have to have different trucks running down the street for those commercial and the residential.
Mr. Chair. Senator Fisher. How successful are you in sorting the commingled? Can you pull the glass out and brown glass and that kind of stuff to be that definitive, or just pull glass and plastic?
We have the capability of meeting at least 70% color sorted at the facility. Okay. And what we do is then we look at the markets. We have three, before we had one entity after our glass market, and they did a wonderful job. And they're currently vying for those materials right now, and we also have two other entities that want those materials. We have a total of three now that are competing for our products on that glass.
Mr. Chair, what happens, obviously plastic doesn't break like glass, and so you don't have a breakage problem. If you grab a plastic, even if it's mashed or torn or something, it hangs together, you can sort it out pretty easily. But where glass breaks into fragments and stuff like that, when you have just all that stuff commingled, is there not a breakage, or where you're having to kind of sort the bigger pieces, let everything so small go, or?
Yeah, we have a lot of breakage, and we use some different technology, air classification, and trommeling to separate the material so that we just get into a glass stream. And that's where we end up separating between the clear glass, which is we recover that 70% of that clear glass, and then the brown, which is very small in this residential stream, and the green, they go together, and Owens allows us to go ahead and mix those together, because it's only 4% on the ground that we're talking about. We do have a lot, but for those 130,000 people, well, we've got four people that separate the glass and the tin and the plastic and all of that right now, versus each of the recycling drivers out there before. In our company, we used to have 21 trucks on the road, and we're down to 17 today, with our target of having 15 on the road next year at this time.
Senator Fisher? So successfully in your operation, you can overcome the, to a large extent, the pain in the neck it is to people that have to have so many containers out there and haul them in and out of the garage and whatever the case might be. Being up here, I don't get to have much of a problem with sorting in close to the ground rule, but because you have don't use a delivery, but, or a pickup, but up here, having the three different barrels is done right where we're
times because I'm not man enough anymore to haul through.
Yeah, I don't blame you. Yeah, we can do that. And it takes commitment. It takes commitment from a collection standpoint and also from a processing standpoint. And that's where I think every one of us as recyclers, we need to honor that commitment the public has entrusted us with. So.
Mr. Chair, at your request, I don't like Amendment 1.
You don't? Okay.
Thank you. My real concern is for towns smaller than 250. I represent Sanipac. We are a large hauler in our community. We serve 39,000 homes, but we do look to Portland for the movement of technology and how things are done. And so I am concerned with that amendment. I got to tell you that the last 15 years, the focus of the garbage man has been to get people to recycle. I'm here to tell you right now that the focus now for the garbage man is to find out how to take a very labor-intensive, time-consuming job of recycling at the curb and make it more efficient and control costs. We hear this from the cities and counties who are our boss, who are responsible for reviewing rates, and we hear from them each time as we cannot keep having rate increases based off of just solely the manpower that takes to go out at the curb. We have 39,000 homes that we recycle. 93% of them are now recycling, and that takes a lot of time, and we don't want to see an amendment that would preclude technology coming on board where we can do the collection of recycling as efficient as we do the collection of garbage. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Any questions?
Yes,
Mr.
Chair.
When you commingle, now, let's just say that a person didn't want to do any kind of separating of the house at all and just stuck everything in the garbage can. Are you able to then sort that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Brian Engelson again. If it's just put into the garbage can, theoretically, yes, it could be done. But we're not doing that. We're trying to keep the recycling separate from the garbage itself. And none of the facilities within the state are able to do that right now. It's possible, but we haven't done it.
I just was curious, Mr. Chair, if for my own knowledge here and making decisions and stuff on it, if it was practical to just totally put everything in and regard this at least as long as it's separated by the homeowner, at least you don't get it with all the wet garbage and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's important.
I have some testimony, Mr. Chair, I'll offer, and if you have questions, I'd be happy to come back up.
Oh, that would be great. Thank you, guys. What I'm going to do right now, we have others to speak to Dash 1, but right now what I'd like to find out if there's anyone who would like to speak to the Dash 2, the hand and growth part. If not, I'm going to have Brad explain where we are in relationship to the hand and growth issue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we've got a couple options open to us on the Dash 2 amendments. We could pass them out conceptually and send them through LC. If we do that, we are going to have another hearing to officially pass them out in the LC form. It's unclear to me without talking to the President of the Senate's office whether or not we can get permission to do that next week, or we need to attempt to schedule some sort of a meeting for Friday evening, which might not be realistic.
They come up with these...
Don't get me started.
We'd be here until September anyway.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with the consensus of the committee that we probably could get it done if we passed that conceptual amendment, because then we would simply be holding the hearing for the purpose of doing a formality.
All right, so you guys are your preference. Do you think we're going to have a problem to do that? All right. Okay. With the threat of strike, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 940. And at this time, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 1316. And the chair would move Senate Bill 1316 to the floor with a due pass. Is there any seconds?
Dick Thompson.
I'm a big no on this. No, I'm just kidding.
He said he was here to ensure your vote.
You know, I'm not afraid of him. You know? He's gotten older. He doesn't run as fast as he used to.
Is there any discussion relative to the bill?
Oh, well, let's go.
Seeing no discussion, the clerk will call a roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 1316 is passed, and I will carry it. And now, let's open a work session on Senate Bill 1231. Oh, yes, you're right. I need to close the work session on Senate Bill 1316, and I need to open the work session on Senate Bill 1231. Grant, tell us where we are there.
We're back with our name.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, excuse me for just a second. Excuse me, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 1231 imposes mandatory forfeiture and loss of hunting privileges when a person is convicted of certain offenses where crime involving the killing of livestock. With the indulgence of the chair, we held a very brief hearing on this on the 21st, and we're not able to take any public testimony, but there was one person that was signed up, and that is the sponsor of the bill, Glenn Stonebrink. And I do believe he had requested to make a brief statement about the intent of the bill. And additionally, Senator Corcoran has offered -1 amendments as well.
Mr. Stonebrink. Have you seen the -1?
For the record, Mr. Chairman, Glenn Stonebrink with the Oregon Cattlemen Association. No, I have not seen the -1 amendments.
I'll support that. Okay. I think they can open this line.
If I may absorb, Mr. Chairman, for a moment, the -1s and just speak to the bill, and then that will sink in when we finish here.
All right.
Mr. Chair, maybe if Glenn wants to look at this, Mike, while he's doing that, tree to explain why they're proposing it. Mike,
that would be good.
Keep things long.
Okay.
Hi.
And for the record, and tell us about -1.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Teresa Miller with the Oregon Humane Society. And we very much support Senate Bill 1231 and the concept of increasing penalties for killing of livestock. And we propose taking this bill one step further, and this concept is in the proposed amendments, the -1, which would add the clause injuring, damaging, mistreatment, or killing of livestock resulting in a loss of hunting privileges. And we feel like intentional cruelty or killing of animals, anyone who is engaged in these acts does not deserve a hunting license. So we would support increasing the span of the bill.
Is that the cattleman who's herding these cattle to the stock car to go to the slaughterhouse?
No, it's not. Actually, Mr. Chair, the amendment would add inserting or 167315, so someone would have to be convicted of intentionally injuring, damaging, or mistreating an animal to be eligible for that.
And in the current law, that would not be construed to be that, because we have some.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Mr. Chairman, I'm wondering, in the statutes that stated in the original bill, it exempts any practices which are considered to be good animal husbandry. I'm not sure the Dash 1 amendments has that same... it does. Okay. Any practice of good animal husbandry is not a violation of this section. Then the language on line 6, insert injuring, damaging, mistreatment of. You see where I'm cold here with these, but if that were added in there, would that, the intent of the maker of this, be that good animal husbandry would fit into that as well?
It would not. Those are basically...
Okay, one second. Brad, just looked up. Brad, would you go ahead and clarify the course of where we are?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, in addition to the crimes already listed under the bill, which probably bear repeating, in its current form, the bill would affect the following acts: criminal mischief in the first degree, casting artificial life from vehicle while possessing certain weapons prohibited, animal abuse in the first degree, aggravated animal abuse in the first degree, aiming rifle from moving vehicle, finding artificial light on game, mammal, predatory animal, or livestock land or near motor vehicle and while in possession of weapon restricted. The dash ones also insert ORS 166.63, which is casting artificial light from vehicle while possessing certain weapons prohibited, and 167.315, which is, again, animal abuse, but that's in the second degree.
Changes, Mr. Adding animal abuse in the second degree session.
Right.
Yes, you're correct. Yes, I stand corrected. 166.3 is already in there.
Okay, Senator Ferrioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was curious about was the additional statute 167.315 that's been covered in your expert leadership of the community, Mr. Chairman. And the only other question I guess I had was, as the chief sponsor of the amendment, or of the bill, I was curious as to why the amendment wasn't brought to me, because I support the amendment and the bill.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ferrioli, I apologize that I did not do that. This was sort of a last-minute addition. I apologize. I didn't check with you first.
Accepted and noted, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. And let's just get this thing down the road.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Fisher.
Some clarification on this last thing. Shining an artificial light on a game mammal, predatory animal, or livestock while entering a motor vehicle while in possession of a weapon restricted. Does that mean that a person couldn't protect his livestock by going out with a spotlight and shooting at a wolf or a coyote or a cougar or something in the process of protecting his livestock?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fisher, there's exemption if you're on your own land. That does not pertain if you're on your own property. If you're on your own land, that section doesn't pertain, so you can shoot a coyote at night with a spotlight on your own land. Just like a lot of cattlemen check their cattle at night with a spotlight for calving purposes, and they have a rifle right next to the back window. So,
okay.
On your own land.
That's correct.
Or land that you manage.
Checking from hell, protecting the deer.
Yeah.
I think we're good. Mr. Chairman, that's 1 minute.
Guess we were in 1 second. All right, let's do it. Without objection? So moved.
Mr. Chairman, the bill is amended to the floor.
Okay. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll. Thank you, Sue.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 1231 is passed at a committee and sent to the floor with a due pass. And Senator Farioli, if you will carry that.
Mr. Chairman, I give that on to Senator Corcoran if you'd like it, and I'd ask also to invite Senator Corcoran to join the sponsorship of the bill if you'd like to do that.
Pleasure. No, absolutely.
Okay, very good. We'll do that. Senator Corcoran will carry the bill. And I will close the work session on Senate Bill 1231. And I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 1264. 1264. Brad, tell us where we are there.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 1264 changes determination of maximum amount of costs available for certification for renewable energy tax credit, allows administrator of Office of Energy to consider kind of renewable energy facility and certifying costs, eliminates sunset on renewable energy facility tax credit program, exempts certain biomass facilities from requirement to obtain site certificate from Energy Facility Siting Council, specifies acceptable evidence of indebtedness for eligible public entities receiving small-scale local energy project loan funds, expands kinds of businesses and projects eligible for loan funds, applies changes in tax credit programs to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, year 2000. Mr. Chair, we heard this bill originally on the 21st and took public testimony in support of the bill in addition to the Dash 1 amendments. But we did not have a quorum at the time and we were unable to move the bill. We do have some of those original presenters available today if you would like to have them summarize the Dash 1 amendment.
And we do have a referral to this on this one also, don't we?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. This has a subsequent referral to revenue. It bears adding that the last bill we just heard had a subsequent referral to judiciary.
All right, so we need to get
what? So why does 1231 have a who's he has to get?
Senator Corcoran, it creates a new crime. I believe it's routine to send those folks to judicial.
Okay, we are in a work session, and but if there was any need of the committee to have any of the folks who testified relative to renewable energy come up, everybody happy with this thing? I think everything in the file is very positive.
Renewable and Dash 1.
Dash 1, sir, SB1264.
Without objection.
SB1264 as a move to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
Senator Wilde has moved. Oops, we need to go to revenue.
Okay. Move that we say SB1264 is meant to revenue with a due pass recommendation.
Okay.
I'll probably get to carry it from there.
Senator Wilde has moved Senate Bill 1264 to the Committee of Revenue with a due pass. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
All right.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 1264 is amended. It will be sent to the Revenue Committee.
Senator
Farioli, would you like to register your vote on 1264?
Aye.
And my vote is aye.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay. I don't know if I tap the gavel. I'll go through it one more time. Senate Bill 1264 will be sent to revenue at a due pass recommendation. And I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1264. And I'm going to open the work session on Senate Bill 238.
Mr. Chair, I was late getting here because I just spent about a half an hour on a similar, almost identical bill in trade and economic development. Do we have to go through this twice?
You do. Can you tell us what happened?
Yes, we passed it out to the floor with a due pass to the waste means of the due pass recommendation.
And that would be establish an independent commission.
Yes.
Okay. We have a little bit of a different issue tied to this one. Brad, you want to tell us where we are? Did I the work session, didn't I?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I did. Okay.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 238 transfers certain duties and functions of the Superintendent of State Police relating to boxing and wrestling to the Oregon State Boxing and Wrestling Commission, codifies existing contested case hearing procedures, changes title of Administrative Officer of Boxing and Wrestling Commission from Administrator to Director. Mr. Chair, when we last heard this bill on the 26th, you asked that the parties involved, namely the Oregon State Police and the Oregon Arena Corps, try and reach a compromise language. In fact, they had been working on that previous to the 26th, and the Dash 4 amendments are the result of that work, and they, it's my understanding, they represent an acceptable compromise to both the State Police and the Oregon Arena Corps, and those, we have representatives from both available if you would like them to discuss the specifics of the amendments.
I think that might be a great idea, too, and if we could address implications of the bill that just passed out of Trade and Economic Development. What would you like to know? I didn't know if you heard that discussion. I'll let the three of you decide who's going to go first. State your name for the record and proceed.
Juan and I begin, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Jerry Conkling, representing the Oregon Arena Corporation. Mr. Harper has indicated, the Dash 4 amendments do represent the consensus that we were able to achieve with the Oregon State Police. We told you about this conceptually when we were here on Wednesday, or Monday, or whatever day it was that we were here, the 26th, which is Monday. As I indicated at that time, we had worked on language relating to creating essentially a special type of regulation for a touring group. We dealt with the issues of a physical exam that would be satisfactory to the commission, consistent with its mission of protecting public safety, as well as looking after the well-being of the participants. And finally, we dealt with the issue of financing the issue of the fees to work out an arrangement that recognizes that sometimes we do have user fees that are already applied, but at the same time fees need to be available for the commission to carry out its functions. So these were the issues that the committee members raised, we're content with this language. I think Captain Miller has one Scribner's issue that came up. As you're aware, Mr. Chair, these amendments came to us via the House Majority Office that happens to have an occupant with the same last name as Mr. Harper. So after we unraveled that mystery today and discovered our amendments were someplace else, when we looked at them, and Captain Miller can indicate what it is, that there would appear to be just a Scribner's error in here. And I'll let him, if you wish, just note what it is.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first I'd like to say that we support the Dash 4 amendments.
For the record.
And we believe that it is consistent with the legislative mandate that you gave the commission.
If you could state your name.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. Captain Bob Miller, Oregon State Police. 1987, this body gave the commission the legislative mandate to adopt rules for the conduct of professional boxing and wrestling that promote the safety and best interests of the contestants and the public. And we believe that the spirit behind these Dash 4 amendments do that. The technical adjustment that we'd like made is on line 16 of page 1 in the information we gave the Legislative Council yesterday, ORS 463.113-2B should be deleted.
463.113 and 2B.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Senator Corcoran.
So that I don't have to look it up. Is it because it's an irrelevant?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran. All of these citations here refer to licensing, and that's part of what the Dash 4 amendments are for, is make it easier for a touring group coming out to individually licensing. 463.113 deals with the broad powers of the office superintendent. In this bill actually being shifted to the commission, we've worked hard on this amendment. We don't want to create any confusion down the road, and so it's an overbroad area, and it doesn't speak specifically to what we're trying to accomplish here.
Sure. I guess the parliamentary question I was sort of raised is, given, can we treat it as a scrivener's error and move the amendment?
Brad and I were just talking about that. Why don't you go ahead and tell us where you think we are?
Mr. Chair, Senator Corcoran, it's my understanding from what Captain Miller said that was never intended to be in there, and it appears to be an oversight. Therefore, I would suggest we do treat it as a scrivener's error and allow legislative counsel to correct it when they endorse the bill.
Okay.
I'll ask each of the committee members to go ahead and mark that off then at this time before we proceed. That's what we have in our possession, right? So here, so we understood what we...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for purposes of recording this into the record, the mistake that's going to be eliminated from the Dash 4 amendments is on page 1, line 16, after the first ORS statute 463.025, comma, the following statute 463.1132B will be deleted.
Just for the record, Mr. Chair, you note that the document that you're referring to is SB 238-4 LC 732. I mean, just so you don't get confused with the bill.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Fisher?
On C of page 2 of the amendment, line 7.
Mm-hmm.
If a wrestler has to have a distance vision 2100 in either eye and near vision of 2040 is measured by a near vision chart, does the referee have to have those same qualifications?
Not in the wrestling.
Get out of the way.
I'm almost supposed to be part of it.
I'm afraid
why can the person wrestle if he's blind?
That was put in for the benefit of the Evander Holyfield fight, Mr. Chair.
That would have to be a tooth exam on that.
Well, I was just scanning to make sure there wasn't frozen desserts in here, huh? No mention of that, please. Senator Wiles.
Thank you. I'd just like to ask, in going through this, first of all, on page 2, what no body parts that are dysfunctional. Well, now that sounds very interesting.
Keep the legislature up.
What? Yeah, I know. That's what I think. Well, no. But, I mean, that's a very... Do we have that defined anywhere? Because, I mean, if I have a movement of my arm from here to here, is that dysfunctional if, in fact, you determine it really should go to here? I'm very curious.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wilde, actually, the original language that we discussed said no deformity. This comes from the physicians that we had involved in this dialogue, and dysfunctional, the way it was explained to me, is non-functioning. And so in the specific example that was used, and it goes toward injury, trying to prevent injury, and the example that they used was if you had a right arm that wasn't working, that you could injure it, you know, break a bone, any number of things without knowing it. And it is sort of injury reduction, protection of the contestant.
Okay, interesting. I would have just used other language, but could I also ask about page 3? Thank you. Now, we had heard about the 6% gross receipts tax. And how that was not at all right. And now I see in the wording that it can be offset but not to exceed 2/3 of the 6%. Is that considered acceptable to get events in here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Wilde, Jay Isaac with Oregon Arena Corporation, Portland, Oregon. Yes, we've been working hand in hand with the promoters as we've gone through this process with Captain Miller, and that's, you know, my strong conviction is that this particular relief will get the job done.
Okay.
Are there any further questions from the committee?
Yeah, there's
okay.
Senator
Shannon?
And I'm sorry, but it's his question that if we pass this bill, professional wrestling will come back to Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Shannon, yes, that is correct. That's my expectation, that if this bill in this form passes the House and Senate and is signed into law, that we will have, in due course, professional wrestling.
Yes. Sorry you had to ask this question.
Okay. Seeing no further questions, who would like to deal with Dash 4 amendments?
Let's move the Dash 4 amendment to SB 238, including the conceptual alteration of the Scrivener's error.
Okay. Now, if I can get that back out. Senator Wild has moved the Dash 4 amendments with a correction to Scrivener's error on line 16, page 1, to Senate Bill 238 without objection.
Chair, I'd move that the 238 amendment to the floor with a... It does go to the floor, yes? Okay, to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair?
Mm-hmm. Senator Fisher?
If you're changing that over and changing funds, does it not have to go away from you?
Page 3.
President,
come on. We have a person who thinks they have an answer.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm very confident representing the Oregon Arena Corporation. And we are talking about here user fees that would be generated at the event, so I don't believe that this will have any revenue impact whatsoever. And, in fact, the user fee that we're talking about is intended to cover costs of regulating the events themselves.
Yes.
Even if there's no direct cost to the community, because it's absorbed by taxes, you still have to have any breach in spending limitations cover that, which is passed through. So I think if it's over $50,000, there might be a reason to waive it past ways in the end.
Okay.
If it's a revenue, it goes to the revenue committee. It doesn't go away from me.
Then the question whether or not the taxes enclosure is the question whether or not the spending limitation of the agency is right.
It still can go to the floor, and the president will refer it to where it should go.
Well, let's add to the spending side of it, and then see if it's revenue and wages.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Captain Miller, this amendment has no fiscal impact on the Boxing Wrestling Commission.
Have a revenue impact.
Mr. Chair, Senator Wild, this. The way the Boxing Wrestling Commission is set up right now, you have a budget, but you also have a mechanism by which if there's excess revenues that are gathered, we don't have a crystal ball on the number of Holyfield fights or Tyson fights or anything like this. So we could theoretically bring in $1 million on pay-per-view fees and assessments. Anything above the legislatively approved budget, that's that money that goes into the Children's Trust Fund.
Governor would love to have it because Senator Miller would enjoy this bill immensely, but I think we just extend it to the floor.
All right. We're going to go ahead. Senator Wild has moved Senate Bill 238 to the floor as amended with a due pass. And is there any further discussion?
Only that I think Senator Miller should be asked to carry it.
Right.
I think so, too. Yeah.
Oh, no longer.
Yeah. All right. Any further discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye. And I want you to prepare a list of important aye. Questions for him. And I will
aye.
Aye.
See if it involves life.
Aye. Aye. Senate Bill 238 has been passed before with a due pass, and we're going to ask Senator Miller to carry this. And pass the gavel, and before I close the work session, I would like to thank the participants in this for the hard work
And I think this may be something very entertaining for the people of Oregon, yeah, in addition to the hearings that we've had.
The other benefit, Mr. Chair, of having Senator Miller carry it is that all the flack that's going to pursue in the Oregonian will be directed at him and not this committee.
Not
yes. Bell Conkling rights, it's with a L.
With that positive note, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 238. And we have, what, one left, don't we? Okay, and I'm going to open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 980-980. Tell us where
you intend to pass this tonight.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 980 extends farm labor contractor licensing requirements to limited liability partnerships and limited liability companies and certain nonprofit corporations that provide education or training to workers. For new requirement that majority shareholder of corporation or limited liability company be licensed as farm labor contractor if corporation or limited liability company stock is publicly traded. We have two sets of amendments. When we last heard this bill on the 21st, it was observed that the amendments included a section that was not intended to be included, and that has since been removed, and that's represented by the Dash 2 amendments. In addition, we have Dash 3 amendments. And I'm going to... Yes, we have, and Dash 3 amendments have been proposed by the Farm Bureau, and perhaps you might want them to speak to the nature of those amendments.
Yes, yeah,
Paul Tiffany is Bureau of Labor and Industries, apparently, has introduced the Dash 3 amendments. I apologize for that.
I need to get kicked out of here, though. I'm close on.
Oh, you want to kick out of here?
All right. Mr. Chair, if you prefer, since we discussed the Dash 2s at the last, essentially discussed the last Dash 2s at the last meeting, perhaps it would be useful to have Paul Tiffany from Bureau of Labor and Industries brief us on the Dash 3s.
Okay, let's do that. Senator Fisher is needing to leave, and just as soon as we can, so if you folks would abbreviate it, would be greatly appreciated.
This is
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Tiffany. I'm the Government Relations Manager for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. Thank you for hearing this bill. With me is Mr. Corey Park, who brought a problem to our attention at the last hearing and is the reason for the Dash 3 amendment that you have before you. The purpose for the bill in the first place, on page 2 of the bill, lines 7 through 12, deals with licensing majority shareholders in a corporation. And what our intention there was to facilitate licensing of farm labor contractors as majority shareholders by allowing large corporations who were substantially capitalized not to have all their majority shareholders licensed. We thought we took care of it with the language that was in the bill, but Mr. Parks brought to our attention that, in fact, he didn't. And so, as a result, we worked with Mr. Parks and others to come up with the Dash 3 amendments, which we believe does resolve the issue that we were trying to do, and that is to streamline licensing under the Farm Labor Contractor Law for corporations and majority shareholders. And if you'd like to get into detail, I'd be glad to do that, but perhaps Mr. Parks can.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Corey Parks. I'm here on behalf of the Nash Corporation, one of the larger timber owners in the state of Oregon. And we discovered, as Mr. Tiffany stated, that there was an omission in the Senate Bill 980 as proposed, had a tremendous amount of difficulty becoming a licensed farm labor contractor in the state. It's a matter that has each year causes us to jump through many hoops in order to get licensed, and the primary problem is the majority shareholder requirement. We have 150 private shareholders, and they're all across the nation, family-held corporations. It's very difficult to get all of those people to sign on to become the majority shareholders. The Bureau of Labor and Industries proposed this Senate bill in part to allow publicly held corporations to waive that portion of the licensing requirement, the majority shareholder. And this amendment, the Dash 3 amendments, are addressed to either non-publicly traded corporations or other privately held corporations that are sufficiently large enough to make the Bureau feel comfortable that they are, that they can qualify for that waiver of licensing.
Good work, sir.
Okay, so first we move to that.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 980. And I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 980. Senator Wild has moved the Dash 2 amendments to 980 without objection.
I will move the Dash 3 amendments to SB 980.
Senator Wild has moved the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 980 without objection.
And I will move SB 980 as amended to the floor if they do pass recommendation.
Senator Wild has moved Senate Bill 980 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Are there any further discussion? Okay, the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Senate Bill 980 is sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Corcoran.
Do you know if the good Senator Stillwell would be interested in sharing this? Or?
Yeah, I think she would.
Okay. Let's do that.
Now for sure.
We'll ask her now. Okay. Great. We'll have a backup on Senator Corcoran.
Is it her bill?
Yes, it was her bill.
Is she aware of the amendment?
Okay. And if there's any further business from the committee? Done. We will be adjourned.